All right, what do you think? Real or an overreaction? We will lead with the markets today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 5th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I mean, crazy up yesterday, right? Crazy down today. Clearly, something is going on. The question, of course, is what, and what does it all mean? Sudeep Reddy is at Politico, also a Friday regular on this program, as you know, here on a Thursday to help us make sense of things. Hey, Sudeep.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so look, how much of this is a sober second thought reaction to what Jay Powell said yesterday? Because Powell said yesterday, economy's really strong, we're going to work the problem, we're not going to raise rates too high, right? We're not going to do 0.75 percentage point, and everybody was happy, and now everybody's sad. What's up?
Yeah, these last few days and really these last few months is in a bigger picture what it looks like for Jay Powell to be yanking the punch bowl away from the party after lots and lots of people have gotten wasted. They're confused, they're stumbling, they're drunk. We're just going to go through these phases of ups and downs, intense volatility, until everyone can really kind of figure out what's going on. Like, where are we as an economy? Where are we as a stock market? We had the drunk phase with GameStop and all that nonsense early last year. And it's just a very long, painful hangover to get to this stage. And it's a process. And that's, unfortunately, what it will feel like for a while, a very long, painful process.
That is no way to go through life, son. So look, how big a problem is the volatility, right? Because we're all going to get whiplash if we have 1,000-point or 900-point gains and losses back-to-back for, I don't know, like a couple of months?
Well, it could be a couple of months, could be a couple of weeks. Look, the market being down a few percent after being up a few percent isn't a big deal. But this period of constant readjustment and realignment across all these asset classes is just stomach-churning volatility for investors. It is for businesses as well, when they're particularly publicly traded ones, when they're watching stock prices move in this way. And it can lead to risk aversion, and it could actually take some of the euphoria out of the economy. Is that such a bad thing? That's actually kind of an ideal scenario for Jay Powell, where people slow down a little bit and calm down a little bit, and maybe bring down some of the pace of inflation as it gets into services and wages, bring it down just a little bit. But this is the version of a soft landing that he's aspiring to. Is, can you bring down stocks without bringing down the economy? It's really just a question of how much damage is going to be done to each along the way.
Say more about that, because Sabri did a piece for us yesterday along those lines, right? That part of what the Fed is trying to do, and of course, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, the Fed will tell you, oh, they don't worry about the markets, right? But they like to deflate asset prices a little bit, so there's a little bit less of a wealth effect, and everybody's a little bit more circumspect in their spending, thus possibly helping to bring down inflation.
Yeah, and look, any loyal listener of this program knows the good times, and we've said it over and over and over, the good times weren't going to last forever when it came to ultra-low interest rates.
Right.
This is the cleansing process. This is the payback. The junk stocks went first, now the frothy tech stocks. It's the general, the big leaders that are starting to pull back as well. That's where it starts to hurt in 401ks a little bit, but it's not devastating. In Jay Powell's mind, he has to think, would I rather be the guy who burns some tech investors who kind of lost their minds along the way after he's been warning them for a while about this? Or would I be the guy who wants to burn 300 million people in the country with years of wrenching inflation, which is the path that he knows that we were headed to? And so he is really trying to prevent that scenario where he's remembered as being the guy who allowed inflation to get entrenched. And he's so far managing this okay. We're going to get on Friday a new report on the labor market.
Yep.
Is it holding up? If it is, then maybe you should just think about your 401k in the long-term perspective. If the economy is holding up, markets are going to be fine. If it's not holding up, we have a lot more trouble. And then you get into the weird, super weird zone of if the economy is not holding up, the stock market is probably going to do better as a result due to Fed expectations. And those are the things that kind of twist your mind in all sorts of ways. But what the Fed chairman's going for is keeping the economy in one piece while overall markets just do their thing as they do, that is the ideal. The soft landing means keeping it together without breaking anything.
Sudeep Reddy on a Thursday, as opposed to his usual Friday. He's at Politico and sometimes with us. Thanks, Sudeep. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Guy.
Talk to you soon. On Wall Street today, so look, here's your indicator. There was 10 times as much down volume, that is to say, shares trading lower than there was up volume, more than 10 times as much down than up, actually. Details, numbers, you all know the drill. All right, so here's something else to ponder macroeconomically. From the Department of Labor today came word that worker productivity in this economy shrank 7.5% in the first quarter of the year, the biggest drop in that statistics since 1947. 47. Marketplace's Savannah Marr is on the Primer desk today.
Think about how you measure your productivity at work. For me, it's something like, how many stories did I have on Marketplace during the hours I recorded on my time card? Economists ask a similar question on a larger scale.
We look at all of the goods and services produced in the economy in a given quarter, and we see how many hours it took to produce that.
Sarah House is a senior economist with Wells Fargo. She says high productivity means workers are making more money, companies are making more money. But in the first quarter,
that would actually decline while you had hours worked shoot up.
A few things could explain this, says economist Erica Groshen at Cornell University.
There's been a lot of hiring.
Lots of vacant positions, too, and new workers who aren't getting as much done. Then there's the supply chain crisis.
Inputs have been slow to arrive. Workers have been kind of sitting around idle more of the time waiting.
Plus, Omicron, says labor economist Aaron Sojourner at the University of Minnesota.
We saw millions of Americans missing work, either because they were sick or they had to take care of people in their families who are sick.
And the thing about losing productivity, it's not going to help with rising consumer prices, says Sarah House with Wells Fargo.
Productivity is an escape hatch for inflation.
When productivity is high, businesses might be able to deal with higher costs without raising prices. Instead, she says businesses have been passing those costs along to us. The good news? Labor productivity data tends to be pretty volatile, so one bad quarter doesn't necessarily make a long-term trend. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
I'll observe here just in passing that the Federal Reserve, in addition to being the guardians of interest rates, is also a key banking regulator in this economy. And it was in that capacity today that the Fed, along with the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and the Comptroller of the Currency, announced an update to the 45-year-old Community Reinvestment Act, a law that, among other things, was meant to get banks to invest in their local communities. Now, think for a second about how much banking has changed in, like, the past 5 years. Forget 45. And you can understand why the CRA needed a shakeup. Marketplace's Matt Levin is on it.
The Community Reinvestment Act basically says if you open a bank in a low-income neighborhood, you can't just take that neighborhood's deposits and lend them only to richer, usually whiter neighborhoods.
Its genesis is really in the civil rights era.
Mark Morial is president of the National Urban League. The big problem now is the law hasn't been updated since 1995. You know, back when people actually used to set foot in banks.
We believe that the new fintech sector, those that focus on online banking, that should be covered.
Online banks can offer mortgages or checking accounts anywhere in the country, but legally they only have to invest in areas where they have a physical presence. The new rules proposed today could change that, says Jesse Van Tol with the National Community Reinvestment Coalition.
Going forward, banks, including those without branches, will be assessed not just where they have branches,
but wherever they do significant business. Richard Hunt with the Consumer Bankers Association says he'd like to see those regulations apply not just to chartered banks, but to fintech companies that offer bank-like products.
They're eating their ice cream and their cake, being able to serve consumers and not have any regulation whatsoever.
The Fed, FDIC, and Comptroller of the Currency are taking public comment on the 600-page rule through August. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
According to the Guttmacher Institute, that's a reproductive health and rights organization, more than half of the abortions in the United States are what are called medication abortions. That's preliminary data from 2020, by the way. 54% is the actual number. But medication abortions are pills that can be taken at home. The procedure is approved by the Food and Drug Administration for the first 10 weeks of pregnancy. And during the pandemic, the FDA lifted its requirement that patients actually see a provider in person to get the medication. Capitalism being what it is, businesses quickly set themselves up to help patients meet with providers virtually and get the drugs they need by mail. That business model, though, could change, and quickly, if the draft Supreme Court opinion leaked the other day sticks. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on that one.
The FDA approved medication abortion back in 2000, and advocates of abortion say it's a major difference from where we were before Roe v. Wade.
Unlike back in 1972, in 2022, we do have safe and effective medications that put the power back into people's hands.
Kiki Friedman is the co-founder and CEO of the company Hey Jane, a digital clinic for medication abortion, where a patient can fill out a medical intake form online, be in touch with a provider, and get drugs to end a pregnancy mailed out to them. The company launched early last year and now treats patients in 6 states.
So we're in New York, California, Washington, Illinois, New Mexico, Colorado. We picked states that account for 52% of abortion volume nationwide, but also those that are most likely to receive a lot of patients traveling in a post-Roe world.
Or if patients can't travel, they may try to get medication through mail forwarding, says Elisa Wells, co-director at Plan C, which provides information about how to access medication abortion.
So we know people are, you know, using virtual mailbox services, getting an address, doing a telehealth consultation, and then having that pills shipped to the virtual mailbox and then forwarding it to themselves in the states where they live.
There could be legal risk to all of this for both the patients and providers like Hey Jane. Rachel Rebuchet is interim dean at Temple's Law School.
If you're providing web-based services, can a state go after you as a provider if you mistakenly provide an abortion to someone in Texas that doesn't allow telehealth for abortion?
Rebuchet says another open question is whether states will go after manufacturers of abortion drugs as well. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's crazy.
I'm sorry. I'm going to need more than that. First, though, let's do the numbers. No, now you're just trolling me. I'm going to have to talk to somebody in management. Dow Industrial's down 1,063 points today, 0.3%. Finished at 32,997. The NASDAQ down 647. That's on the point scale, almost 5%. Closed at 12,317. S&P 500 fell 153 points, 3.5%, 41.46. Regular down on a day like this. E-commerce companies struggled on fears that online sales might not keep up the strong growth they had during the pandemic. eBay dropped 11.7% today on worse than expected revenue guidance, though the company did post first quarter profits yesterday that beat expectations because that's the way that goes. Etsy tumbled 16.8% again on a weak forecast for the current quarter. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, 3.03%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Seattle, Washington is home to Sound Community Bank. Lori Stewart, president and CEO. We've talked to her a couple of times the past couple of years, mostly about pandemic-era relief programs and how things like the Paycheck Protection Program, if you remember that, how they were working out. Today, though, with that half-point Fed interest rate hike in the books, we've gotten her back on the phone. Lori, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
How, first of all, is business at Sound Community Bank these days?
Well, business is good. And one of the things that I think is really significant is of those 1,515 PPP loans we made, all but 13 of them are paid off, and the vast majority were forgiven. Isn't that awesome?
That's actually really good. And not only just for what that means for small businesses, but that they could figure out the paperwork and all that stuff, right?
Exactly. For all the kind of bemoaning we did about the program and getting it up and running, it really sorted out very, very well. So it makes me smile.
What is your sense of how small businesses are doing up where you are?
Isn't that a great question? Because I think it varies so much about what kind of business you're in. Certainly, we're seeing it's like I have to park within the lines in our parking garage now because there's so many people back around. But I do think it varies. However, our sense in our market is that people have relatively positive attitude. They're concerned about supply chain issues in some cases, but they're doing okay.
Huh. All right. So let me ask you to step way back from the small businesses that you and your staff deal with on a daily basis. And I'm going to take you to Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve, right? And interest rates are up. They're probably going to go higher. What happens at a community bank when the Fed says, okay, 50 basis points, half percentage point? What happens?
I think people jump to a conclusion. They read a headline that rates across the board are going to move. And that just isn't true. Banks are going to set rates for both loans and deposits based to a degree on competition and also what they've got. Right now, we have lots of liquidity in the banking system. I was talking to two other bank CEOs just yesterday, and we all have lots of cash on our balance sheet. So we don't need a lot of deposits. So I think there will be a lag to see deposit rates go up. But likewise, you won't see every loan rate go up. I mean, if you got one of those great low-rate mortgages, that's not going to change.
Yeah.
If you have a variable, you're going to see an adjustment over time. But not many people took variable rate loans.
Yeah, although yes. I did see the other day that adjustable rate mortgages are coming back. But let me ask you this about that.
Yeah, they are coming back.
Yeah, let me ask you this about that competition thing you said, right? So the Federal Reserve raises the federal funds rate. And you and your colleagues in the banking sector in your neck of the woods and bankers everywhere say, well, the guy down the street is only given 0.3%. So if I give, 0.35, then I can get a little bit more business. Is that what we're talking about?
So to a degree, but it's a little bit more nuanced than that.
Yeah, well.
We take in deposits because that's a great service to customers. And most of them either earn an interest rate or they're like checking accounts that are free, right?
Mm-hmm.
We deploy that money in loans to our clients. If we've got more deposits than we've got loans, there's not a lot of incentive to pay up for more deposits.
And I guess that's why when my mother calls me and says, how come I'm not getting another 0.5% of my certificates of deposit? I guess that's the answer,
that's
right?
Exactly the right answer. Yeah, right. Exactly. And it's not because there's any kind of crazy price fixing or that kind of thing. It's just that because of the stimulus and because people were locked down and cautious, there's a lot of cash sitting on bank balance sheets. And so that need to raise rates to keep making loans just isn't there yet. Will we begin to see it? Sure.
Well, that's what I was going to say, right? Because the Fed's going to raise rates maybe a couple more times this year. And at some point, it's going to trickle down, right?
It's just a lag, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Lori Stewart, she's the president and also the CEO of Sound Community Bank up in Seattle. Lori, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time, as always.
Thank you. Always enjoy it.
Cast your mind back with me now to the spring of 2020 and the ways people found to occupy their time as everything shut down. Binging whatever they could from their streamer of choice, right? All that bread that got baked and gardening, so much gardening. A survey from the National Gardening Association shows that most of those pandemic gardeners have kept at it, and the number of first-time gardeners is rising, mostly millennials and Gen Zers. And a third of them say they're growing their own produce as a direct response to skyrocketing food prices. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer on gardening economics.
It is raining. Not pouring, just a slow, steady drizzle. The kind that gardeners love, unless they're standing around talking to a reporter.
Now, how is your electronics with rain?
Well, we're going to find out.
Okay, that works.
That was Stephanie Burke asking me about the durability of my recorder and microphone. She's a farmer who's now starting a community garden in Potomac, Maryland. She's just broken ground, but has already leased out 8 plots. 4 other plots will be used for teaching local students. Extra produce or plants from the whole garden will be donated to food banks and other charities.
Let me show you what we're doing. So this area right here, you can see all the farm equipment.
On this rainy day, Burke is teaching some new gardeners the ropes.
First of all, what do you really want to grow? What does your family eat?
Missy Sarah wants to plant tomatoes, cucumbers, and maybe lettuce. She's a realtor in the area who found out about Burke's project and decided to give gardening a try, partly because she's spending so much at the grocery store, as much as $200 a week.
It's like almost doubled. It's crazy.
Missy Sarah's got company in other parts of the country. In Seattle, Rona Gala plunked down about $250 for an indoor growing system back in March. Gala is an accountant, so he knows how to calculate return on investment. At first, he didn't expect to save any money with his growing system. It was just a hobby, and he was only going to grow herbs. But now he hopes to expand into tomatoes and peppers.
I started seeing more news about inflation, and I thought, okay, this system might actually have some more use than what I originally bought it for.
Gala is 34. He's a millennial. In a survey by Garden Center magazine, more than 300 independent garden centers reported that last year, their customers started skewing younger. Kate Spurgeon is the magazine's editor.
65% said they saw an increase in millennial customers, and 44% saw an increase in Gen Z customers.
In fact, Dave Weidinger, who heads the National Gardening Association, says almost 17 million Americans started gardening for the first time last year, and most of them were millennials or Gen Zers. Weidinger says almost a third of new gardeners surveyed by the association in January said they were growing their own food to save money. Weidinger has done some return on investment calculating. He says for a basic garden,
it's going to cost you $88 to make this garden, and you'll get $700 worth of food out of it.
But there are many variables that can inflate the cost of starting a garden, Weidinger says. You may live in a part of the country with crummy soil, so you have to amend it to make it better. That takes compost. If you don't have the time or space to make your own compost, you have to buy it. Maybe you also need fertilizer and tools. You might have to put up a deer fence to keep critters out. Ka-ching! Which brings us back to Missy Sarah at the community garden in Maryland, where they're divvying up the lots.
Would you like the ladybug lot?
I would like the ladybug lot.
Absolutely have the
ladybug
lot.
They're good luck, so.
Sarah will pay $100 to lease her plot. That includes compost, fertilizer, tools, and a deer fence. But Stephanie Burke warns her, be realistic. You may not grow $100 worth of food your first year.
If you're expecting to get 1 million bushels of tomatoes and you don't, then you might be disappointed.
Oh, wait, forget it. I quit. I'm done.
Every new gardener needs a learning curve, Burke says. When you're first starting out, you may actually lose money. But over time, with the right soil, lots of sun, and maybe some luck, you can grow so much food you have to start giving it away. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in keeping with my promise to mention Twitter and the guy who wants to buy it only when there is news, Elon Musk has convinced a bunch of friends to chip in about $7 billion to help cover part of his $44 billion purchase price. Larry Ellison of Oracle is in for $1 billion, a couple of venture capital firms as well. Also, a cryptocurrency exchange called Binance.com, the CEO of which told the Financial Times today, quote, "We, from our friends, heard that Elon was looking for third-party investors, and are we interested? We immediately said that we are," and then he went on. "He didn't have a plan for Twitter. There isn't, like, a business plan, so it wasn't that type of discussion," end quote. This is just me here. What could possibly go wrong? All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It is a number, and that number is 5.27. That is the average interest rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage. Data courtesy Freddie Mac, the big government conglomerate, a week or so ago, 5.1%. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.